Well, good evening.
Good evening.
And this is an interview for the Michigan Writer Series, Friday, December 7th, 2001. I'm talking with Robert Root, professor of English at Central Michigan University, who teaches nonfiction, editing, and composition, in addition to publishing his own creative and academic works. Welcome to MSU, Dr. Root.
I'm glad to be here.
When it comes to literature, which would you say you are first and foremost, a teacher, an editor, or a writer?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've nicely balanced between all three aspects of my career. I'm a teacher, and I teach composition, and I teach nonfiction. We have a master's program in composition and communication at Central, and I've directed master's theses in creative nonfiction, collections of essays, memoirs. Mm-hmm. I like that role. I like being a professor. I've written a lot about nonfiction lately and about the teaching of composition in the past, and I like doing that. Nowadays, I'm trying to push forward my career as an essayist and a memoirist, as a nonfictionist. Mm-hmm. And so at the moment, I'm concentrating on that, but most days I think I'm all three wrapped up in one. It's very nice to be able to do that, to be able to write something and teach it and research it, and I'm never sort of at a loss for something to say.
Good. Last year, the MSU Press published Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan. The collection was edited by Michael Steinberg, but he acknowledged in his introduction that you were the one who suggested putting together such a book. What led you to pitch that to him?
Well, I'd thought about the idea of the title, at least, for a long time. I had read Letters from the Leelanau by Kathleen Stocking, mm-hmm. and admired it and got to know her. And I thought there was more good nonfiction in Michigan than was generally acknowledged. Mike and I had just come off of doing a collection for the classroom called The Fourth Genre, mm-hmm. Contemporary Writers of On Creative Nonfiction. And Mike was looking for something else to do, and I had my hands full, so I said, here's an idea, and I told him about it. And he ran with it, and I think created a really lovely book. I was quite pleased to be in it, and partly because it's so good looking, and because of all the other things that are in the book, all the other things by other people.
Well, many of the writers who are participants or past participants in our series, Kathleen Levy, Mark Shan, Michael Delp, and mm-hmm. others. Mm-hmm. So it's been great to read their work. And I've actually, met most of them, so that's cool, too.
Yeah.
Your contribution to Peninsula, the essay Pilgrims and Pioneers, is in part about your travels to Isle Royale National Park and your work on editing the mid-19th century journal of a former resident of Isle Royale, a young woman by the name of Ruth Douglas. Did finding Mrs. Douglas's journal serve as motivation for you to become an artist in residence on Isle Royale?
Well, partly. I had found her journal about 1989, and it was credited as being to Mrs. C.C. Douglas. And it turns out that Mrs. C.C. Douglas, everyone thought, was Lydia Douglas. No one knew there was a first wife mm-hmm. named Ruth Douglas. And so when I first went to the island, I thought I was researching Lydia Douglas.
Oh.
And I was partly going to the island because I had been there the year before with my wife to visit my daughter, who was working on the island, fell in love with the island, had seen a television program in which the poet Keith Taylor mm-hmm. is shown at a cabin on Tobin Harbor on Isle Royale writing poetry by kerosene lantern. And I thought, I would love to be in that spot. So I applied to be really an essayist, but I thought I could do the research on Mrs. Douglas while I was there. When I came off the island, I found out that, in fact, it was a different person than everyone thought, and that I was the only one who knew it. And so I felt even more of an obligation to recover her identity and to get her diary in print. So I've really been doing both those things, being an essayist and being a researcher. And as it turns out, in 1998, I published her journal mm-hmm. called Time by Moments Steals Away. And I think that in 2003, when I publish Recovering Ruth, that'll be my book. And so we'll be even. Each of us will have his or her own book.
Would you tell us about Recovering Ruth, please, and how doing the research into Mrs. Douglas's life led you to look at your own life differently?
Well, part of it is what I was just suggesting, that I had discovered that the person that everyone thought wrote this was someone entirely different, and no one even knew she existed. And once I found out that there was a first wife, mm-hmm. I started looking around, and I started noticing the clues that were in the journal, that clues that didn't make sense when I thought of Lydia Douglas. But when I knew it was Ruth Douglas, I knew that she was connected to Oliver Newberry, the Admiral of the Lakes, and so on. Everything fell into place. Mm-hmm. And I went to look up things about anyone named Ruth Douglas, found out when she died, found out where she was buried in Detroit, went to visit her grave to see if I could find out anything else, found that she died in childbirth and that her son was buried with her, a 3-month-old baby. And I just felt like I have an obligation here, you know.
Yeah.
I say very often in the book that I talk out loud, mm-hmm. and that's one of the natures of that project, is that you end up feeling that you know the person involved. And here I'd spent, 4 years thinking of the author as one person who died at the age of 80 in 1912, mm-hmm. and found out it was a woman who died a bare year and a half later at the age of 24.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was attached to her. I felt a sense of obligation, a sense of responsibility. And it got me thinking about how easy it is to lose your identity after you've lost your life, that so many of our lives are just vanished because no one's there to preserve it. So I thought, with her diary, at least I can bring her back to life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the one thing that survives of her, and now it's out there. And as long as there's a Michigan, there will be a copy of that in a Michigan library. So that's good. But then I found that what was happening to me as a writer, as a biographer, was interesting also. The sort of the way in which you get personally involved in something that has nothing to do with you, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably true in lots of cases. I also, at the same time, was writing a book on E.B. White, mm-hmm. which was much more academic, analyzing him as an essayist, because I'm interested, how did he do those wonderful things he did? But I knew everything there was to know about E.B. White, and everyone knows that E.B. White's there. I didn't have responsibility for him. But I still felt, by the end of it, that I came to know him in ways that other people don't know him. And I think that's just the nature of scholarship. So finally, I ended up also feeling I know a lot about research, about mm-hmm. genealogy, about history. I could use this with my own life. I could come up with a history that say when I pass, my children would have, and they could go on from there mm-hmm. and say this is how we got to where we are. And that's actually one of the projects that I'm working on is the story of my growing up in my hometown and how my family got there and all the strange circumstances behind
Great.
That.
Well, I know too that you really encourage people who have family members who've written down stories or even written their autobiographies to mm-hmm. try and publish them, you know, to preserve them, if not for family, but for the public at large, because no one is of inconsequence. I mean, every life touches, you know, so many.
Right.
Have you known any people who have taken your advice and tried to publish family stories?
Well, I did a tour, I think in 98 and 99, a couple times, going to historical societies, museums, libraries, and doing workshops with people who are working on genealogies, and just trying to tell them, here's some things that you could do.
Mm-hmm.
That would preserve it. Part of what I was trying to get people to do was take family diaries, manuscripts, letters, mm-hmm. And maybe give them to archives, to places that will keep them out of sunlight, out mm-hmm. of light, out of rain, out of mildew, not be passed around to people with peanut butter sandwiches in their hands. And yet edit them, get them ready, and circulate them. Mm-hmm. And I think I've known a couple of people who have been doing things like that just among their own families. And a couple of students at Central have done master's theses taking diaries, not necessarily from their families, mm-hmm. but I teach a course called textual analysis and editing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we do is do what I did, go into historical archives, find a journal, a series of letters, a diary, and try to do at least a portion of that, transcribing it into an accurate text, researching the background, trying to figure out who wrote this. Mm-hmm. It's been interesting because we found in a couple of places where people have been identified as the authors who weren't the authors, mm-hmm. Or they found little clues that people didn't know about. And in a couple of cases, the students got so caught up in it that 2 years later, they were back at it. They'd been working on their own on this, and said, can I do this as a master's thesis? I said, yes, you can.
There must be tremendous satisfaction in realizing that you know something about someone that no one else knows.
Yes,
Mrs. Douglas's true identity and, mm-hmm. and so forth, and your students or some of your students have found the same sorts of things.
And you find that in those diaries and in those journals, there are people. Mm-hmm. You read them. People don't realize with their own diaries how much of their personality, their worldview, would come across to another reader. Something comes across on the page. And for me, that's worth reading. There's a book that Michigan State University Press published called Adeline and Julia. As it turns out, Adeline Graham is my wife's great-grandmother.
Wow.
And I had read that journal, mm-hmm. Passed around in a transcript in the family, and thought, somebody ought to just write this up and publish it. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, somebody did. And that's another good example of something where the personality comes across on the page.
Cool. I have a lot of personal interest in that. A great aunt of mine wrote out her autobiography.
Oh, yeah.
And included, so many stories of family members, handed down through the generations. And I encouraged her a few years ago, Auntie Anne, this is publishable. This is incredible, not just for us, but I think people would be interested in it. And, memoir writing is all the rage. And mm-hmm. and she just laughed, who would want to read about a silly old woman like me? That's all she thought of it.
And yet there's treasure trove of historical facts, details about everybody's lives. The idea of those things, disappearing in someone's attic mm-hmm. under the bats is not very cheering to me.
No, not at all. Not to any lover of the written word. Well, what do you see for the future of creative nonfiction, the so-called cutting-edge genre? Is it a publishing fad, or is it here to stay?
Well, I think certain things are fads. Mm-hmm. A lot of attention that the memoir has gotten in recent mm-hmm. years is probably going to fade. There's been a backlash against nonfiction. I'm not quite sure why, except that sometimes people are afraid of something that gets popular. On the other hand, nonfiction has always been with us. I've said somewhere that when Mike and I did the fourth genre, we wanted is to say nonfiction is a form of literature too. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks of literature as three genres: fiction, poetry, and drama. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the fourth genre was. It's saying there's another genre. But the more I've been thinking about it, the more I think we should have called it the first genre, because I think nonfiction is how we all communicate first. Mm-hmm. Something happens in the world. you know, hunters go out and somebody gets stomped by a mastodon, and someone else has to explain what happened. Mm-hmm. That's nonfiction. The idea of putting it into meter and rhyme and singing it, poetry, that came later. First, there was the accurate telling of what happened. And in the same way with fiction or the same way with drama. I mean, I think that everything starts with fact. And that's where literature starts. So maybe nonfiction is the first genre. The other thing is that most of us who are essayists at least trace ourselves back to Montaigne, who influenced Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. He died in 1588, and that's a long time ago. The essay's been around a very long time. The memoir's been around a very long time. So it's not going anywhere. I'm not worried about that. And the exciting things that are going on in nonfiction are some of the most exciting things that are going on in literature. So I think that'll keep happening for a while yet. I'm not quite sure how long.
You certainly hope so.
But that's what I'm going to be doing is playing with nonfiction for a long time.
Do you think for the remainder of your career or life that you'll be focusing more on nonfiction than on academic work?
Probably more than the academic. Although it's so easy for me to go both ways. Mm-hmm. I go to conventions and talk about nonfiction. I teach it, so yes. I'm still interested in how you teach it and what happens with it. And I'm interested in sharing those ideas with other teachers. But I've got a number of projects that I would love to be doing about places I've been, mm-hmm. about my family, about travels of various kinds. And so that's probably what I'll be doing most for the next 50 years.
Well, good. This Is What the Spaces Say, a presentation on segmented essays that you delivered earlier this year, you stated, the truth is hard to know, and it's hard, ultimately, to explain, perhaps especially about our own lives, what we experience as participants, what we observe as spectators. Would you say that's the moral of nonfiction, or of writing nonfiction?
It's certainly something that everybody who writes nonfiction has to think about. Mm-hmm. That when we talk about fact, when we talk about truth, we're really talking about our truth and what we perceive in the world. And we know truth differently. The segmented essay, which some people are afraid of, is actually a part of how everyone gets their messages every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the beginning of the 21st century, everything is fragmented. Try to watch a television show. I remember television shows when they didn't have commercials. And there was a continuous story. I remember seeing movies in theaters where they weren't geared for being shown on television, so that there's a dramatic climax every 10 minutes or so. So I think particularly, say, your generation, mm-hmm. is much more familiar with segmented ways of doing things. My students never have a problem with Pulp Fiction, for example, or Magnolia, or they mm-hmm. love Memento. Mm-hmm. And these are things, or even the Blair Witch Project, which people my age were running out of the theater saying, I'm getting such a headache. You know? I think we get our information in fragments. I think we get them. We get them in music albums. We get them in sonnet sequences. We get there's all kinds of way in which we get our information, and it's never 100% conclusive. So I think what nonfiction is doing is trying to make that a strength of what you're doing with nonfiction, mm-hmm. of how you get ideas across, and not think that you have to have a thesis statement and all support and evidence all the way through and make an argument. Because one of the things we find out is a lot of times argument is fudging the truth in order to win the argument.
Well, I found in your essay, Pilgrims and Pioneers, that your use of the fragmented form was very effective because you interwove your observations, your first visit to Isle Royale, with that of, you know, the observations of Ruth Douglas. And, you know, I could see how you were trying to imagine what she must have thought of her life there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how isolated she was, and how your almost a sadness came across in your writing that she probably didn't venture very far into the island to really observe the wildlife and so forth. She only ever mentioned once seeing a wild animal in her diary, and it was just a beautifully done essay, you know, using that fragmented format to juxtapose the two different stories.
And my students very often find, when I give them examples like that from other writers, that it frees them up to tell stories in different ways. I mean, that there you have a sort of a braiding of two strands.
Mm-hmm.
And when students approach narrative, very often they think they have to start at the dawn of time and go right up to this minute. And the story gets away from them. There's no way to highlight it. There's no way to emphasize it. These various approaches that nonfiction has been, I think, pioneering and emphasizing work for everything. But they help us focus things. Juxtaposition is one of the ways we know things. And that essay is an example of that. It would not be, however good an essay it is, if I had tried to do it in a linear format.
Mm-hmm. I misspoke and I said fragmented instead of segmented.
That's right.
It's segmented, not fragmented. You tell a complete story. But you mentioned some films, Memento, Magnolia, Pulp Fiction, with that kind of storytelling narrative. And that, I guess, we see more and more in pop culture now.
Right.
I read the review of a play that works from the beginning of a story and the end into the center.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's set up on stage, from stage left to stage right, the past, the present, and then the future. But it works its way towards the present from both extremes. So, you know, I can understand how perhaps that started in nonfiction, you know, creative nonfiction, and now is moving into other other mediums.
You can see it. You can see it in film. You can see it in fiction. It may be just part of what happens in the age, but it's nice that nonfiction gets the chance to do this, because I'm reading Cherry by Mary Carr now, and most of it is done in second person. Which is a really interesting way to do that. There are a lot of things that you can do, and the main thing is what's effective, what works, what reaches the reader. I think in nonfiction, particularly, we've had to teach the reader how to read what we're writing. The more you experiment with form, the more you have to teach the reader how to read it.
Yes.
But once the reader understands what you're up to, it's less of a problem.
Well, aside from your work, which was influenced by spending time on Isle Royale and discovering Ruth Douglas's journals, what else has living in Michigan brought to your writing?
That's a good question. I have just realized that I'm almost to the point where I've lived in Michigan as long as I lived in the place where I grew up. Michigan, I've been here for 26 years, and this is my home, and I feel like a Michigander rather than a New Yorker. I've particularly loved the lakes and the woods and the beauty of the state. I've never gotten over Lake Superior or Lake Michigan, and will go there every chance that I can. I think that's the thing that has most impressed me, that there's so much that's so beautiful here.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are racing out to the Rockies to find something to write about the natural world are missing the boat. There's really wonderful things here. So I've been trying to see more of the state and get that sense of it and take it into me, and it's been working pretty well. I'm working on a collection of essays that has a lot of just short essays or somewhat complicated essays about places in Michigan. I think of myself as an essayist of place more than anything else if I'm trying to describe what I do. And By that I mean that where I am sort of permeates the way I look at the world. And I'm trying to think of how my personal history intersects with the natural history of where I am, or the cultural history of where I am, or all three together. And Michigan's a rich place for that. Isle Royale certainly has been. I went back when our book came out, The Island Within Us, and all of the artists, or a number of the artists in the book, were there, and all of us wanted to come back. All of us wanted another shot at an artist in residency there.
Well, I bet.
I was wandering around thinking, if you give me 2 more weeks, I'll have half another book, you know. Good. So.
Well, I think any reader of yours can understand your love for and respect of nature and Michigan's beauty. You
know, good. I hope so.
The geography and so forth, like canoeing the sky. I could picture you out in your canoe and the reflections on the water and you know, being familiar with the clarity of the water. And when Superior's calm, which is not very often,
right.
I can imagine how beautiful it is. And I love your simple statement that, you know, Michigan is a place surrounded by water, but it's not oceans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very unique place in the world in that respect. Now then, aside from the collection of essays, you're writing about places in Michigan and also finishing touches on your manuscript, Recovering Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other projects you're working on?
I'm working on the memoir, which is called Locks, an album.
Oh, okay.
That's growing up in my hometown, and I'm going to read the opening piece from it tonight.
Good.
And you'll get a sense of what I'm sort of driving at. My idea was to create a memoir that's mostly about pictures and using the pictures as jumping off places for memories, because I'm finding that it's very hard to sort everything out after all this time. And I don't know how long that'll take. I'm hoping it'll be done in a year or two. The collection of essays, it's so hard to figure out what goes together. I was a radio essayist for 8 years on WCMU radio at my school,
mm-hmm.
and did very short pieces, 4-page essays. Did about 250 of them.
Wow.
And they're so varied. It's so hard to figure out, do these things still work? Do
mm-hmm.
do you have to hear them rather than read them? So that is a sort of torturous process. I'm also working on, I hope, a book called A Nonfiction of Place, in which I will talk to a number of writers who write about place and have them explain how place figures in what they do, and then reprint or give me a new essay about where they're from. And it's people who've been in Nova Scotia and Kyrgyzstan, mm-hmm. Crete, Idaho, Nebraska, Western New York. My contribution will probably be something about Michigan, probably in the past. You know,
oh, okay.
Because I'm also interested. How do you get a sense of a place mm-hmm. when the place is 150 years ago? Or I did an essay once about the Anasazi, and mm-hmm. I mean that was sort of the milestone essay for me, because it just blew me away being in Chaco Canyon or Mesa Verde,
mm-hmm.
And yet. That's 1,000 years ago that
yeah.
those people were there. Why am I so, you know, so struck by this? And why do I feel so at home here? So that's a big project. And otherwise, I don't know. I usually find something to do.
Good. Well, I certainly wish you live another 50 years to complete all of these projects. And I wish you luck with them. And I just want to wish you luck as well with your reading tonight and say thank you, Dr. Root, for joining us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks.